hi, and welcome to SourceCast Episode 0. I'm your host, JD.
And I'm Jeremy.
And this show is more going to be, well, we wanted a good Linux podcast, because there are very few of them out there, and most of the ones who are out there are either extremely evangelical towards one distro or one group of people, radio.
Or they involve John O. Bacon, or in some cases, both.
Yes, yes. You know, or they're like old school Slackware whores who have been using Linux since 1993, and you really don't learn anything. They're just there bullshitting the entire time. We're going to try and be, you know, we're going to try and make this fun, have some humor, but also we're going to review distros on multiple levels.
Real, honest, practical reviews, not the sort of OS news and distro watch crap where it's a bunch of screenshots and, oh, look, here's a feature that nobody really used, but it's a great to be little checkbox on the final ship product.
Yeah, exactly. The ratings we're going to try and give distros that we review are going to be, first, the granny rating. The ease of installation, ease of basically getting a working distro, codecs, non-free software like Skype and Flash, stuff like that, and the default theme. Because your grandma isn't going to want to go in and change the theme and go to GNOME Look and find a good theme and stuff like that. Our second is going to be for the power users. Basically, is it customizable and flexible? And what's the ease of compiling stuff? Because you will have to compile stuff. That's, you know, inevitable. And getting bleeding edge software. The next one is the annoyance factor. This one, yeah, there are going to be a bunch of distros that get high ratings on this. Because basically, we don't want it to be too annoying and where the distro gets so much in the way of either of the first two.
My favorite example on this is if you go and try to install support to playback MP3s like, say, most of the planet wants, and Richard Stallman appears on your desktop with a tambourine singing Kumbaya and gives you a 30-minute dissertation on why you are evil for installing MP3 support, that would be highly annoying.
Yes. Also, you know, stupid design decisions like, you know, Fedora 9, which we might review in the future, perhaps not, deciding to go with a development version of Xorg that no binary driver supported for over a month after Fedora final release. Very intelligent, Fedora guys. Go you. Next is the software selection. How up-to-date are the repos? And how big are they?
Yes, after 3 months of using the distro, are you 4 or 5 versions behind on Firefox with no hope of upgrading unless you go and do it yourself?
Yeah. Which, if you've ever compiled Firefox by hand, it's, well, no fun. Next is going to be community support. Basically, we're going to go around to their forums and their IRC, and if we have any problems, we're going to ask for questions and we're going to lurk in there a little bit to see how, you know, problems get handled. One of the reasons I kind of like Ubuntu, even though Ubuntu sucks, but we'll discuss more of that next episode, is because it's got such a vast community that at the Ubuntu forums, for example, you don't even have to make a new post. 90% of the time, your problem's already been solved, asked and solved by people, so all you have to do is search. And finally, performance. Basically, we're going to be using Geekbench just to do a quick performance test of the distro, and, you know, if it makes our Pentium 4s run like, you know, Celerons, it'll lose some points for that.
Yeah, the number one impact on that is probably going to end up being bloat more than, you know, something like Gentoo or Arch, where you can compile and tweak your C flags and so on and so forth.
Ubuntu, you know, compared to Debian, and also it'll give you a good comparison of, hey, Ubuntu got a much lower score than Debian. I wonder why that is. And, you know, you can look into that more if you feel like it. What we're going to be discussing this episode is we've got a bit of news to cover. In the past week, there's been some huge news in the open source community. And we wanted to explain basically who we are and, you know, what we've done with Linux. You want to start, Jeremy?
Sure. I started with Linux because way back around Christmas of 2000, I got a new computer exactly how I wanted it from Compaq. Hey, don't laugh. Compaq wasn't that bad back then. But unfortunately,
still pretty good.
It came preloaded with Windows Millennium Edition.
Oh, God.
And so it didn't take me very long to say, this is a load of shit. There has to be something, anything out there better than this. And so I tried Mandrake. At the time, I think it was 7.0. And this was mid to late, closer to mid, kernel 2.4. And Mandrake did okay. It had a nice control panel, which sort of eased me into things. And the hardware support was really the biggest problem. My Onigy card had a terrible time working. Video support, you know, I could, it was fine, but 3D acceleration was pretty hopeless. And it had the additional problem of every 6 months there was a new release, and if you stuck around on the old one, you would quickly find things would start breaking, and you'd have to start going to rpmfind.net and installing manually, and it would just get really messy.
Yeah, and also back in those days, there wasn't anything super easy like nice repos and nice package managers. If you wanted to upgrade, you either did a reformat and reinstall, or you tried manually getting all the RPMs, downloading that craziness.
And I stuck it out with Mandrake all the way until I believe it was 10.2 or so. And at the time, I bought a Hapag PVR250 with the hopes of using Myth TV on my desktop system. And I really researched hard to make sure it was a card that would work, and everybody said, "Yeah, it'll work fine. Yeah. It's great. It's exactly what you want." Well, what they didn't tell me was that in Mandrake, the installation and setup guide for Myth TV was about 6 or 7 solid pages of commands and crap you would have to do. And of course, every 6 months, you would have to turn around and do it again when Mandrake released another release. And that got really old, really, really fast. And so I said, you know, there's got to be a better way. And so I just, in a fury, ran through distros trying them to see if there was a better way. I found it was much the same at the time with Fedora. I want to say back then I was around the time of Mandrake 10, right, you know, one of the last few releases before they changed to Mandriva. And I want to say it was like, yeah, Fedora Core 4, maybe 5 back then. Something close in there. I tried that. Ubuntu wasn't even really known back then. It may not have even existed. I tried all the major distros you can think of. I tried, pretty sure, CentOS. Basically, if it was in the top 10 on DistroWatch, I gave it a try and found to be, because basically at the time all you had was Red Hat variants and Debian variants. And ones that weren't really that big of a variant. And all of them had the same problems regarding Myth TV. They might not anymore, but I ended up moving to Gentoo, and the sort of law of using Gentoo is the first time you install it, it's going to kick your ass, and you're going to screw up mightily, and you're going to have to start back over. And I did. And it ended up taking me probably a full week before I had everything installed and set up decently well. And I'm actually still running that install from several years ago today on my desktop, and I use it on all the other machines I have now, all my servers, my laptops, and so on. And I found that with Gentoo, at least, I would have to set it up the first time, and Gentoo would actually do most of the hard work for me through use flags. All I really had to do was set up a database, which was, that's sort of an automated process. It's like one command and it's done. And set up the back end with the database, password, credentials, go create an account at Zap2it to get TV listings, and tell Lyric which dev device was my remote control, and that was it. That's like a quarter of a page compared to how it used to be. I was like, this is it. This is game over. Why bother going through all the pain? And so I've stuck with that. What I really like about it are it's got a real palpable speed increase. And that doesn't come from compiling with, oh my god, go faster, or fun roll loops, or, any other stupid C flag that anybody who develops GCC would laugh at you for even mentioning.
Or like 09 or anything crazy like that.
Exactly. I think that's pretty much mostly from the fact that if you compile your own kernel, you're only throwing in there what you absolutely want. At least if you're man enough not to use gen kernel, which pretty much anybody who uses gen 2 will say, why the hell did you use gen kernel? For example, my laptop is an old ThinkPad T21. It's like a mobile P3-800 with 256 megs of RAM, and Kubuntu on that thing will be just maddeningly slow. I'll yank my hair out. But gen 2 on it...
Don't try and run Ubuntu or any Ubuntu variant on anything slower than a 1 GHz CPU, even if you're running command line only.
But yeah, Gentoo, even with a full KDE, I found to be much, much more usable, actually fairly responsive. And I even got things working that I never could in the binary distros on that ThinkPad. I got full 3D acceleration on that pathetic GPU on that old ThinkPad, a Pro Savage iX, like 8 megabytes of video RAM, AGP2X, but I can play Tux Racer on that thing at Gentoo. So yeah, I've stuck with Gentoo then. I would say what I really like about it is the speed and the fact that I never ever have to reinstall again. I know a couple of distros have since gone to rolling releases, and we'll have to see if they're able to sway me away from Gentoo, because while I love Gentoo, I'm no evangelist. I think there's probably a better solution out there somewhere, if not now, than in the future on the desktop.
And you hate spending 48 hours compiling OpenOffice.
Yes. Yeah, if anybody out there trying Gentoo, do not bother trying to compile OpenOffice. It will give you gray hair. On my desktop, which is a overclocked Pentium 4 at 3 1/3 gigahertz with 2 gigs of RAM, 36 hours later, it was still compiling, and the temp folder for the compile was up to almost 5 gigs. I'm like, gee, good God, how is that even possible?
Yeah, I mean, that's just illogical.
In that time span, I could compile KDE Meta, which is everything KDE related, twice over. But yeah, there's probably a better solution out there for the desktop. If not now, they're probably in the future. And I'm hoping we'll find something out there in the process of reviewing distros out there. But I'll probably have a much harder time being swayed from Gentoo on the server, where I found it having that sort of extreme speed comes in so much handy in a production environment, especially if you get Doug. That extra 10, 15, 20% performance increase can be the difference between people mirroring your site and people still able to load it.
Exactly. I mean, you need that customization sometimes, like for different stuff. You don't, for example, with WordPress, if you're using PostgreSQL, you don't really need MySQL support, so it's better to compile that out and speed it up a little bit.
Yeah, and one of the first things that anybody who uses Apache and MySQL in a high-demand production environment will tell you is, when you say, hey, how do I increase the speed, they're first going to say, well, did you throw away your distro maintainer's binary and compile it for yourself for your needs? Mm-hmm. And if you try and go do that on most binary distros, I'd rather have a root canal. It's awful. Because, I mean, if you look at the compile time config options for Apache would, like, scroll the terminal down 3 pages. It's crazy. And Gentoo makes it just ridiculously easy, a child's play, to roll your own compiled versions of any major app. Use flags are so incredibly handy when it comes to that. And that's pretty much where I'm at today. I'll go ahead and say that I'm a big KDE fan. I like Qt. I'm sort of the exact opposite of you. I have a theory that anything made in GTK will suck, although I will have to give you Audacious, which you showed me, because I've been missing my classic Winamp in Linux for oh so long. And now that Audacious finally has double size working perfectly, I am no longer using OmRock. Audacious is now the only GTK app I still use now that I dumped Firefox for Opera.
I thought you still used Deluge for torrenting.
Okay, yes, okay, two. You got me on two. But Deluge is so... I may try KTorrent, but Deluge is, even if it is GTK, is got to be... It's like 5-10 times more lightweight than Azurius, but that's Java for you.
Yes. Yeah. As I like to say, saying Java is good because it's cross-platform is like saying anal sex is good because it's cross-gender. That argument does not work.
Okay, so where did you get a start?
Well, I got my start in around 1999. I started playing with distros. Back then, pretty much the only two reasonably viable options were SUSE, or SUSE, however the hell you pronounce it, Red Hat, and early, early versions of Mandrake. Basically, I hated it. I thought, you know, I played with it. I thought it was cool because, you know, Linux is better than Windows. But with Lilo, I broke Lilo a few times and I was like, shit, broke it, gotta reformat. You know, now I know you can just chroot in and do a grub install. But back then I didn't, you know. Back then I only knew about the two difficult editors, which are VI and Emacs. And coming from, you know, Windows and Notepad and all those easy things, VI and Emacs were a little bit too difficult.
That's probably an understatement, especially for Emacs.
Yes. And so, you know, also there was no package management. You were limited to what came on the CD. So I basically, like I said, hated them, stopped using Linux for about 2 years. Then a friend of mine turned me on to Debian. Basically, I played with it. You know, he told me about Debian. He told me about K3B, which is the greatest disk-burning app in the history of anything. He told me about Nano. And I instantly started to love Debian, and I started to love Linux. And about 6 months after I started with Debian, I became a Debian developer. And, you know, I was still using Windows at that time, mainly. I was just using Debian for development stuff and for fun. Then, one day in December of 07, yeah, I decided to try Windows Vista. For about a week, I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. After that week, yeah, I thought it was the worst OS any manufacturer has ever produced, including SCO.
Worse than ME?
Worse than ME.
Impressive.
Because the problem with ME is it was crashy and it had, like, no features, whereas Vista was crashy. It had a crap ton of features that were all useless, and it was very, very, very slow.
Which version of Vista did you get? Home Super Ultimate Leet Man Edition?
Yeah, I pirated. Arr. Super League Guy, I Am Awesome Edition.
The internet, all the piracy, none of the scurvy.
I hated it. So basically, I decided to go to Debian. I went with Debian for 6 months, and then I started to get really upset at the Debian community because I started noticing that I didn't notice in my, 5 years of being a Debian developer, a bunch of infighting. Because I was watching Closer Than Ever, because at this point I was using it on my main desktop. So I did the stupid thing, and I went to Ubuntu. for about another six months. I pretty much did not enjoy Ubuntu, I'll put it that way. With Ubuntu, not only is there a bunch of infighting, but the devs have a problem with their brains being missing. So now I am back to Debian. I am back as a Debian developer. And that's pretty much my story. And just to end it, I'm a GNOME guy. I don't think GTK is the greatest thing since sliced bread, but I kind of think it's better than Qt because GTK is written in C.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. At what point did you leave Windows entirely? I mean, did you keep a dual boot around, keep you safe comfort? I kept, though I did dump ME entirely, I didn't dump Windows. At that point, XP was around, and I kept an XP dual boot. And I kept that all the way up until probably 2 weeks after I installed Gen 2, and I said, and at that point I was like, I haven't touched Windows since I installed this, and then I made that sort of great leap of faith to go ahead and go all the way.
I didn't dump, technically I still haven't dumped Windows because I'm forced to use it at work, and it's on my gaming box at home, but I stopped using Windows for like 95% of what I do in January of 2007. Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much my story. And as I said in the beginning of the show, I decided to start this podcast with Jeremy because I think there is a quite serious lack of Linux media. I mean, there are hundreds of podcasts like MacBreak and, typical Mac user podcast, and all these podcasts covering Mac, and like Windows Weekly, and I'm sure there are others covering Windows, but really I can only think of two shows covering Linux, and both of those shows mostly are centralized towards beginners. One's called Going Linux, obviously centered towards beginners, and the other is the Linux Action Show, which is a very fun show, but they don't cover many distros outside of the typical Ubuntu, Fedora, OpenSUSE.
Yeah, there's a couple others out there I subscribe to, but they're not really all about distros. They tend to be more about professionals in the industry, interviews with, people from Sun and people from Big Blue talking about, technologies they're delivering. The sort of thing you really don't right. care about if you're a desktop Linux user.
Right, and the Word or the MySQL people talking about how great MySQL is. Sure, it's great. We all use it on our web servers. But why do I need to watch an interview with the guy who created it who's not telling me anything I didn't know?
Yeah, if anything, you need to watch and pray that Sun just doesn't screw it up, and that needs to be the sum total of your watching for MySQL.
Well, I'll start off. This was going to be a news story, but right now it's the perfect time to say it because it involves MySQL. MySQL has basically failed in my book, and I am about to, in the near future, migrate everything I have that runs on MySQL to PostgreSQL.
What was the big problem that tipped you?
Well, to the people who don't know, Launchpad is Ubuntu's bug tracker, source code center, kind of home of everything. MySQL moved their SVN and their bug tracker over to Launchpad. I just feel like that is a massive failure, because since Launchpad itself is not open source, they're depending on Ubuntu for, you know, like I said, hosting their SVN and hosting their bug tracker, where Ubuntu, you know, like I said, we'll talk about next episode, because next episode is the Ubuntu review, is possibly the worst distro and the stupidest developers on the planet.
I probably won't bash it as hard as you, but I do have some beefs to take up with Ubuntu as well. But yeah, that's a real head-scratching decision. You have to wonder if behind the scenes there wasn't some sort of exchange taking place. Maybe Canonical gets the only prepared binary for a future feature or something, or that's really
possibly.
I mean, that's a head scratcher.
Canonical does that a lot, where like they get, for example, free binaries of Crossover Office are in the Ubuntu partner repository, but for everybody else, you gotta pay. Also, Parallels is like $30 on Mac, Windows, and every distro but Ubuntu.
I mean, that's not like they have a shortage of options out there. There's SourceForge, there's FreshMeat, there's Google Code. There's probably
also,
half a dozen major open source sort of developer areas.
Yeah. Also, I mean, the other thing is, they're owned by Sun. I think Sun can afford to rack a dedicated server for them.
that is
a copy of Apache, Subversion, and like Bugzilla on.
Laughably, that is Sun's entire bottom line, is server enterprise solutions.
Yeah. So why could they not, you know, spend $100 a month, which is nothing for a huge company like Sun, to rack a colo for, you know, MySQL? Makes no sense. But that's what they decide to do, so, you know, hopefully they will... Sun will start to learn when people start moving away from VirtualBox, because it will start getting worse. MySQL, because it will quickly start getting worse, you know.
I hope not for VirtualBox. That's one of the few apps that I really, really love in Linux.
Well, what I think people are going to do if, you know, it starts to go to crap, is I think people will take, you know, 1.5 and fork it. Because really, I mean, that's, you know, that's when they were still working with InnoTech and everything was nice and happy and open.
Okay, so on to some of the big news that has happened recently. I guess we'll start with the one that just finished up recently that's all over the news. Firefox 3 has been released, and I'll go ahead and get your take on it before I sour the whole deal.
Well, I know... I'll say this right off the bat, because, yeah, you told me about this earlier. Yeah, you're an Opera fanboy, but I've been using Firefox 3 since before Beta 1, since, like, Alpha 8, and I'm in love. It's never crashed once. The RAM usage is probably about half of what Firefox 2's RAM usage is, and loading web pages and rendering stuff, it's blazingly fast.
Well, I would say probably a month or two ago, I got tired of Firefox 2 sodomizing my computers for RAM. It got to the point where if I was using Firefox on my old ThinkPad laptop, even if I was running nothing else, it would be exhausting RAM and swapping out heavily. And
right.
So I tried Opera 9.5 at the time. It was like Beta 1 or something like that. And I was like, there's no question. It was how I expected Firefox 2 to have been. And it had little extra things that you could tell that Opera eats their own dog meat. Little extra features that are really handy for somebody who's browsing a lot. You know, like the option to make it a background tab or just a new tab. And I know you can add all these features in with plugins in Firefox, but then you only make the memory problem much, much worse.
Right, but like I said, in Firefox 3, the memory problem is almost non-existent to the point where it's almost as good as Opera for RAM.
And the other thing that I like about Opera, oddly enough, and I haven't used a browser for email and browsing since way back, since before Firefox didn't exist, and all you really had in Linux was Opera with the banner ads, or maybe late Netscape and early Mozilla, and I ended up using early Mozilla. I actually love Opera's built-in email client. It's lightweight, but it does such a good job with multiple accounts that I've sort of fallen in love with it.
I'll be honest, I have two problems with Opera currently. One, it's a Qt app, which doesn't bother me. Well, it bothers me a little bit, but it doesn't bother me much. The problem with it is, it's a Qt app that looks like shit. K3B, I'm happy with K3B's look under GNOME. I'm happy with the look of Copete under GNOME. I'm happy with the look of Conqueror under GNOME. And this is all KD3 stuff. I don't run any Qt4 stuff except for Skype. But for some reason, Opera looks like shit under GTK. I don't know what it is.
This is one of the reasons this is going to be a good podcast. You live up in the Northeast United States. I'm down in the Southeast. You're a big GNOME fan. I'm a big KDE fan. You like most everything GTK. I like most everything Qt. So generally speaking, if we both like it, it's great. And if we both hate it, it's a total piece of shit.
And the other problem I have with Opera is... Adblock Plus spoils me simply because I know Opera can do ad blocking. You have to edit that INI file in your profile.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem with Opera's ad blocking is it's not auto updating.
Yeah, there's no real subscription list. The only thing you have, if you have an ad that slips by, the INI list that I found is probably 99% effective. But for something that slips by, your resort is to right-click on the page and go to something called Block Content. And it sort of has this overlay of the whole screen that fades everything out except for flashes, and iframes and images. And it lets you click on them to block them out. But I think somewhere out there, I wonder if there isn't a third-party plug-in. I mean, worst-case scenario... the INI block lists are fairly consistent. I'm sure you could bodge up a script out there and throw it in as a cron job that would just keep fetching.
And...
yeah, exactly.
But my thought is an rsync binary is very small. It's maybe 100K. And, you know, they ship binaries. So,
I mean, I know...
it's 100...
I know why Opera doesn't want to include Adblock by default. They don't want to get, you know, for the same reasons Firefox doesn't. They don't want to be frowned upon by, you know, people like Google who ultimately fund their efforts through ad-related, you know, through that little search box that has ads on the results. And they don't want to go piss them off.
Like, or people who, like, you know, do their video podcasts and get the money to support themselves through the Google ads. And you're not watching them, so you're not supporting them.
Exactly.
So you're not looking at the Google ads. But still, I mean, you know, at least it should be available as a plugin or as something like that that uses something like rsync to check and update stuff automatically. Because really, yes, it blocks them well now, but you have to remember, like, once a month, to go in and say, hey, time to update my block list.
Exactly.
And I just don't want to do that. I want things to just work.
I totally agree there. That's sort of the only thing I don't like about Opera right now. I wish there was a better solution that didn't require me to go bash scripting.
You know, and that's just not even fun to do. It's just a pain in the ass.
And we've sort of, in a secondary nature, covered one of the other big announcements, which is Opera 9.5 itself, which... I absolutely love.
I gotta say, I play with, you know, I keep playing with Opera. I currently have it installed on my main machine, and Opera 9.5 is a lot better than 9.0.
Yes, much, much better. And I'm glad they fixed a lot of the issues with the betas. You could tell they were definitely betas. It wasn't like Firefox 3 release candidates where you could say, you know, hey, this is pretty much 99% there. The betas had real issues. At times, the rendering performance would drop by double with some releases. Facebook would stop working in some releases. That would be definitely bad for market share in a browser.
Yeah.
And I'm glad to see that by the time they had the final release, they cleaned all that up. I think most of the benchmarks I've seen at places like Ars Technica have Opera by far the fastest, and Firefox 3, surprisingly, pretty close behind Opera.
Now, I have a question for you and for the listeners. What do you all think, you know, of WebKit?
WebKit.
WebKit is Apple's rendering engine. Like, Opera 9.5 has Kestrel, or whatever the hell they're calling it. Firefox has Gecko 1.9 for Firefox 3. You know, WebKit is Apple's, and supposedly, you know, like right now, Conqueror coming with KDE 4.1 uses WebKit by default. Qt 4.4 has WebKit in the Qt framework. So, you know, anything that uses Qt can easily integrate with WebKit. And Epiphany, which is the GNOME browser other than Firefox, is also dropping their Gecko backend for WebKit only.
Well, WebKit is really good for standards compliance. I know that's one of the absolute best for passing the various ACID tests out there for a browser. But that being said, it tends to be shit for practical use of the web. Major websites, guess what, aren't standards compliant most of the time. And so you'll find it just doesn't work in Safari or Conqueror. And if you think you're missing plugins and features in Opera, just wait till you fire up Conqueror and you'll be yanking your hair out. The only way to block ads with Conqueror is to run Privoxy and then run a filter on the proxy.
Actually, that is very incorrect because...
Oh, they got a new
I
one?
I have... in Conqueror 3, and I have it installed right now, I have an ad block.
But frankly, for Conqueror, I think Conqueror's on the way to dying a slow, painful death. It's the file manager has been replaced by Dolphin, or whatever. I think it's Dolphin, right? In KDE 4.
Yeah, I'm sure it's Dolphin.
And really, I mean, I get several million hits on one of my websites, and when I go and I look at the back-end statistics, more people are using a PDA than are coming in off Conqueror. I mean, there's like nobody out there using it.
Well, right now, at least according to my Debian Conqueror, by default, again, at least in Debian, it claims that it's Gecko.
Yeah, I think really that Conqueror and probably Epiphany too, because as GNOME is using Firefox now for the default browser, right? It's all integrated into the system, and
yeah, it's all integrated, but it's still crap. Epiphany by default.
I know that for sure Conqueror is probably going to end up dying a very slow death. I mean, I really see that if anything, the KDE guys will probably just go and add browser capabilities to Dolphin, or add like a drop-in, because you can take Opera or Firefox now, and through their various APIs, you can, with a button, drop in an embedded window that's really Opera or Firefox, but as far as you would know, using Dolphin, it would look like that was Dolphin itself.
Right, using kind of, you know, it kind of sandboxes them,
yeah.
Sort of.
I forget the specific name. I think for Firefox, it's like Zool Runner or something like that. I could be wrong. I could be totally wrong.
Yeah, yeah. Well, but, also, the problem with Opera, though, is, like, Firefox, there is a separate XUL runner and Firefox. Like, in, you know, Debian-based distros, XUL runner does all the heavy lifting. Firefox is just the browser GUI. But with Opera, Opera is Opera is Opera. There is no separation between core and GUI.
Correct.
Which I don't really like that much.
I think, yeah, I believe the API says you have to call Opera with some parameters or something, and it becomes more minimal and gets out of the way and so on.
Oh, one thing I actually forgot to bring up, because This will happen when you're doing a podcast for anyone who's thinking about doing a podcast themselves. You will forget things, but since we're a laid-back show, I'll bring it up now. One of the things that makes me kind of great for this podcast, or that will help make this podcast great, is even just recently, I've used pretty much every distro that you can possibly think of. It isn't just like Debian with, you know, Arabic language support. You know, I've used CentOS, Fedora, Red Hat Enterprise, SUSE, you know, Slackware, Gentoo, Arch Linux. The list goes on.
We'll save it for when we review SUSE, but I'll go ahead and throw it out there. I really, really love some of the features that's in at least OpenSUSE. Yast, I love it. I'm just wondering why in the hell they're still stuck in 2003 where you have to download 4, 6, 8, however many, way too many CDs. Why not just one CD, even if you have to go and fetch stuff you're missing?
Yeah, the package manager is still just as craptastic as every package manager was in 2000.
We'll have to save some of this for when we get to SUSE, since they just released SUSE 11. We'll have to sort of save some of our haste and see if they've corrected their ways.
Yes. News, SUSE 11 was released today. Yay, everyone's happy. No, they're not.
And then the other major news thing we were wanting to cover was Wine 1.0, 15 years in the making. That's not a bad age for a wine.
No, that is not. That is not.
But Wine 1.0
was finally released.
I profess most of my use of wine is through crossover Office because it just makes it so easy and so ridiculously seamless. Right. I mean, installing Internet Explorer is one click. I mean, come on.
Yeah, it's not that easy in Wine.
No, it's not.
But, see, the thing is, well, with Wine, it just, they've tried it and they've gotten decent with it. They've got to make it fit more into native for everyone to be happier.
Yes. If Wine would simply present you with an easy GUI for programs that work, or programs that need known options to work, because Photoshop 7 is one of the classic examples because it works so very well in Wine, but it requires some tweaks to get it really working, and if you just run it with default Wine, you'll have some problems. But in Crossover, they already have the tweaks set and ready for you. So it's seamless. It's a one-click install again. If Wine would just have a GUI that integrates nicely into KDE and GNOME and has basically a wizard that lets you install all the known applications with their special settings easily, it would just make it, it'd be nirvana. It'd be awesome. They'd have to do it not just for the Office software, but for the games too, because if I want to, right. If I'm going to pay for versions of Wine to run Windows software, I want to be able to get Sudoku and Office in one. I don't want to have to go and pay a subscription for both.
Exactly. But see, what I was referring to with Wine things fitting natively is when you install an app in Wine, it feels like you're running whatever app in window, you know, unless it's like full screen without any, you know, with a custom menu and not the typical Windows file, edit, whatever menu. It looks like Windows 95.
Well, that's not a bad thing compared to current, you know, versions of Windows.
This is true, but I'd like it to look more like, you know, 2000 or XP, because at least that would, or, you know, make it fit my GTK or my KDE theme.
Yeah, now that is probably a much nastier coding challenge than it probably seems on the face of it.
Well, the thing is, Firefox, that uses nasty JavaScript for all their code, they pull it off with surprisingly decent ability. Only downside is, you know, Firefox, they kind of say, this plays well in GNOME, it's okay in KDE, It'll suck if you're using XFCE, or not XFCE, it'll suck if you're using Fluxbox. Wine's a lot more, you know, it's not just one application, Firefox, it's every Windows application, so they have to make it work in everything.
Yeah, well, and since you, like you mentioned earlier, you will forget things in a podcast, you've reminded me. The only real beef I have with Firefox 3 is that if you have Flash 10 beta, which, by the way, I love as a release because I can actually view Flash videos in full screen without it mugging my CPU, you know, and looking like, you know, stop motion animation. In what, Firefox what about 3 with Flash 10, it crashes ridiculously often for me. It's okay if you go one at a time, but if you open up a page that's got like six YouTube embeds in it, it can become a problem.
Just wondering, for, you know, the sake of the audience, you mentioned that, you know, before full screening Flash makes it look like stop motion video. What happens if you are watching actual stop motion video on YouTube?
Well, if you're using Flash 9, it will only get worse. Like I said, my desktops say overclocked Pentium 4 at 3 1/3 gigahertz. And a pretty decent NVIDIA 6600 GT. I mean, that setup is good enough to play Doom 3 maxed out. So we're not talking about, you know, system sisters of the poor integrated systems here. But that wasn't enough in Flash 9. After, I think it was like 9.0.47, when they started playing around with GPU acceleration, and it became awful. But that machine couldn't play YouTube full screen at more than maybe 10 frames a second. And it's got to be something with what Flash is doing, because if you go and download the FLV file and pull it up and play it in MPlayer, even on a really slow machine, it's fine. It's totally fine. It's got to be the way they're rendering it out.
Yeah, see, that's the thing. MPlayer is using XV. It's using XORG extensions to play it. Flash is doing 100% CPU rendering, and that's probably why it looks like ass, because the Flash developers are lazy idiots, and they said, you know, let's not care about people, and let's just, you know, make one API so we only have to maintain one code that works on all three OSs.
Oh, make no mistake about it, they are lazy. I brought up my ThinkPad, and it's really crappy ProSavage GPU. And I do have working 3D acceleration on that, but the 3D acceleration comes in X. It's one of the direct rendering extensions they have for like Savage and some of the integrated Intel chips. And if you look at the GLX info output, it has some SGI strings in there. And the way Flash very uncleverly checks to see if you have proper 3D rendering is they check for the absence of SGI strings in GLX info, because software rendering, software OpenGL, will have a whole bunch of SGI crap in there. So if you happen to have a GPU that is 3D accelerated through DRI with X, you're screwed even if you have fully working 3D, just because they're too lazy at Adobe to do it properly.
They're also too lazy to release a 64-bit native of Flash to make it run maybe a little bit better on any system that's been made since 2005.
Yeah, I mean, you gotta wonder what it will take to motivate them to make an actual release that doesn't suck to use in Apple and Mac OS, especially for a PowerPC version, or for Linux, because if they keep screwing around like this, Silverlight is going to, you know, because think about it, Microsoft's already got 90% market leverage to play around with, and if they keep screwing the pooch here, we could have Silverlight replacing Flash, and we all know what Microsoft does when they become the standard. They stop playing with everybody else.
True, but Silverlight, I played with Moonlight, which is the kind of monoified version of Silverlight. Yeah, it sucks about 10 times worse than Flash on Linux.
You don't say, a product from Microsoft that was then ported in .NET to Linux, and it sucks. I'm shocked.
I know. It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, I think that about wraps it up in terms of the news we wanted to cover, and telling you guys a little bit about us. And You'll definitely want to check out our next show, which will be sort of the, how would you call it, the skewering of Ubuntu?
Yes, the skewering of Ubuntu, and perhaps the oral raping of John O'Bacon.
Oh, no.
No, not ear rape for you sick bastards out there.
Oh, you've been listening to SourceCast. This was Episode 0. Check out the website, sourcecast.org. Check out the forums. We're going to be putting a poll up there to see where you want to go with the show, what you think about things. We always value input. And anything to take us out on?
You've been listening to SourceCast, and this is not John O'Bacon.
And this is also not John O'Bacon. See you later, guys.
HPR is sponsored by Caro.net, so head on over to caro.net for all your hosting needs.